matter. If you have any real standing wave ratio on the end of that cable, then the length of that cable is one great big variable that you have to live with. And so this is the main reason why I'm saying that I wish all of the antenna tuner manufacturers would publish a Smith chart and saying that on 80 meters, I'm going to color in this part of the Smith chart. This antenna tuner will correct any impedance in that colored in area, will bring it back to 50 ohms. So for each band, 80 meters, 40 meters, 20 meters, they really should give you a Smith chart and color in the places where it works. Therefore, you know where it's not going to work. Therefore, even if you're in the area where it doesn't work, you know that if you add the right length of transmission line, you will walk around that circle, and you will walk into the area that's colored in. So even if you're standing, even if your antenna tuner, let me drop it. Your antenna tuner will tell you that it will match any phase angle of 4 to 1 standing wave ratio and bring it down to 50 ohms. That may be truthful. However, even though it's only rated for 4 to 1, it may do a beautiful job at 8 to 1 at a particular phase angle, at a particular point of the chart. And so by you adding a little bit of extra cable, or taking away a little bit of extra cable, so that now you rotate into that colored in area of the Smith chart, even though you've got 8 to 1, and your machine is only rated for 4 to 1 all possible phase angles, it could work like a charm. I wish they would give us that information. Yes, if you know the number of picofarads of capacitance of the C1 and C2 capacitor, and you know the number of Henrys of the inductor, in theory you can calculate that. It's not easy for the average guy. There should be some company out there that's offering this extra piece of information, even at a cost. If I owned a $300 antenna tuner, and if for $5 or $10 I could buy a set of charts that are relevant for my antenna tuner telling me that information I just told you about, I'd be happy to pay it. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
So would I, and it would be nice if the factory did it and charge you, maybe they could charge you $5. And just information, they are testing them when they have them up on their setup, so I don't think it would be that difficult for them to provide that. Alrighty, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to my last one. Okay, Dick, KC2WGB, maybe you can set this gentleman's mind at ease. Here's what he has. Okay, it's a pine tree, so a conifer, and he's worried. It's 60 feet tall. He has approximately 100 feet of wire from the top, spiraled like a Christmas tree string down to the base, and about 100 feet of wire. He's using it on 20 and 40 meters. And he has it working very well. He does extremely well with it. 40 meters, the tuner swings no problem. On the 20-meter band, he had to add some extra capacitance to move that into the area where the tuner would work, like you were speaking before. He runs 300 watts. That's his max. And he's wondering, because people have told him he can set fire to the tree. What do you think? And what do you advise? Back to you, Dick.
Not impossible, but very unlikely. Lots of people are worried about this. Water is a very absorptive material. And yes, the tree has got some water in it. However, the water in the tree is inside of leaves, inside of limbs, inside of the trunk of the tree. Wavelength-wise, those are very small wavelengths on 80 and 40 and 20 meters. So the chances of you finding a resonance of a trunk or of a limb such that now you get a voltage maximum of current flow through the sap, through the water of the sap, therefore you heat up the sap and cause this tree to go on fire, very unlikely. By the way, to make enough heat in the trunk of a tree or a major limb of a tree to create fire, very, very difficult. It would take multiple kilowatts to do it. Yes, the little bitty leaves, the evergreen spikes that are on the tree, they would be easy to catch on fire, is the good news. If you held a match under those, you could catch them on fire. To try to light them up with RF is very difficult. Let me drop. Those spikes are what? A couple of inches long maximum. If you were operating at 10 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz, where you could set those spikes into resonance, yes, I could catch them on fire. If you give me a high gain feed on, aimed directly at a limb of the tree where there's a bunch of those little evergreen spikes, and you allow me to put 100 watts into that feed horn, and the spikes are right in the throat of the feed horn, I might be able to catch them on fire. To do that way down at 20 meters, where the wavelength is 60 feet long, and that spike is a couple of inches long, the amount of energy you can couple into that is so small. The only other thing I can think of is that if a portion of that antenna happens to be operating at an extremely high voltage, just because of the way the resonance is set up on the antenna, some portion of it is at extremely high voltage, and now that point is arcing over to some of those spikes, some of those needles, yes. But short of arcing, I doubt it highly. And so arcing is the only thing you got to worry about. On a dark night with a set of binoculars, you have somebody speak into your single sideband rig and shout a bunch of words while you look with your binoculars at the tips of the antenna, the portions that come closest to those needles. Are you seeing any arcing, any corona? If not, the chances of creating fire, not impossible, extremely unlikely. And by the way, this is a spiral-wound antenna. Let me drop it. Technically, the antenna he has built is a conically wound spiral, and his main radiation is the transverse mode, not the actual mode. The helical transverse mode antenna is what he has built, which, by the way, is an invention of John Krause, who invented the helical antenna. Very crafty. I'll bet you he's very happy with it. And so he's feeding it from one end. He might, in some cases, be feeding the outer end of a half-wavelength long wire. The fact is, he's got to add some extra capacitance on one of those bands. He could have corrected that by adding an extra length of coaxial cable. So whether you do it with extra length of coaxial cable or adding an extra capacitor is your choice. I would keep right on doing it. And as I said, go to maximum power, sideband mode. While somebody is talking into the mic, you go out there on a very dark night with binoculars and see if you see any corona anywhere on the wire. If you don't, I think you're home free. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I think you put his mind at ease. And he does extremely well with that antenna. He has reports from people. Plus, he has other hams that don't have that system and wish they did. But that's what they were afraid of, and they're haunting them. So that's good. And I concur. I don't think that's not at 300 watts. I don't think that's possible, only in extreme conditions. But very good. Okay, Dick, that's it from the mailbag. So let's go to Paul and see what he's got. KC2WGB, back to you.
Very fine, John. I hope those people give you feedback and we find out how all those experiments work out. So, Paul, I think very soon we're going to start getting some pictures from Juno. This exotic spacecraft that's inside of this titanium vault to protect it from the extreme radiation of Jupiter's Van Allen belts. And the radiation is so extreme that NASA is predicting that the camera is going to go down the tubes some number of weeks downrange. That's a wicked environment at Jupiter. But we're about to find out an awful lot more about that Jupiter planet. Let me drop. There are a number of people predicting that without the moon around the Earth, which is drastically stabilizing our axis, the axis of the Earth's rotation would be wobbling in all kinds of crazy ways, and such that for 1,000 years, the equator would be tropical, and for the next 1,000 years, the equator would be like the North Pole. The axis would be wandering all over the place if it wasn't for the stabilization we get from the moon. There's a hell of a lot of asteroids and comets and other things that would be hitting the Earth if they weren't being collected by Jupiter. So there are people predicting that the fact that you've got a planet like Earth in the Goldilocks zone, not too close to the sun, that particular star, or not too far away, so it's got the right temperature so that it can have liquid water, one of the major constituents for life. Let me drop it. There were people thinking that in order to really guarantee that life has a chance to form, you've got to have a moon around the Earth-like planet, and you've got to have a Jupiter-like thing collecting all the garbage that ordinarily would be hitting you. And as Neil deGrasse Tyson tells us, yes, there has been, Earth has existed for 4.5 billion years. And for more than 4 billion years, there's been life on Earth. That's the good news. The bad news is that for the first 3.8 or so billion years, that life on Earth was single cellular life. Only the last few hundred years did that single cellular life start building up to the point where it starts getting up. Great big colonies of cells that you and I call plants and animals. So for the majority of the life on the planet, it wasn't the kind of life that we care about. In order to have that amount of time, for that amount of life to finally get around to forming, you need a moon and a Jupiter, is the current philosophy. So although we're finding Goldilocks, Earth-like planets going around other stars, there's a strong belief coming about that you need some other ingredients to make sure you have the right kind of stability for the right length of time so that life gets a chance to form. Therefore, the possibility exists that although we're finding a large number of exoplanets, although we're finding a large number of exoplanets that look like they're capable of life, because of these other requirements, we might be a lot more rare in life than we think we are. As time goes, as we start using the new spacecraft about to be launched, the James Webb Infrared Telescope, among other things, and the Kepler and TESS and whatever, Kepler 2 and TESS, we're doing more and more research as to how many Earth-like planets are out there. We're suddenly discovering that we used to think each star has a million to one chance of having planets. All of a sudden, we're realizing that almost every single star has planets. That's the good news. But how many of them have the right conditions for that planet to create life? We're suddenly discovering there's a hell of a lot of other requirements that weren't so obvious in the beginning. WS2N, our space expert. What's NASA doing this week, John? Paul. K2RIW, you got a Paul.
This is WS2N. Well, let me think. 100 billion stars in our galaxy, I think it is. One time I think I heard 200 billion, but I think the latest is 100 billion. Out of that, I'm going to say probably at least half, if not more. So call it 50 billion suns. Each one has some kind of a solar system. Out of that group, you're going to need Earth-like planets in the Goldilocks zone with moons and a Jupiter somewhere nearby. Probably Jupiter planet is probably common. But we'll have to take that and plug that into the Drake equation. But with at least 50 billion solar systems, I'm sure there's got to be some other ones very similar to us in our galaxy alone. Now you got 100 billion galaxies. That's really gonna add up. Okay, for the space portion of the net, let me drop it. We have a company called Moon Express. I've talked about them on a few nets over the last couple of years. They started developing seriously a spacecraft that could go to the moon, land, and then take off again and go 500 meters and land again and do this over and over again, and at the same time send HD TV back to Earth. I probably started talking about this in 2013. They've been moving along with their development, and just a couple of days ago they got an approval from the government, the U.S. government, to allow them to actually go to the moon and proceed. So we'll see how that works out. They plan on winning the Google Prize. It's a $30 million prize for anybody that could do that. Land, take off again, or just roll across the planet, get around 500 meters away, and then retransmit HDTV. And I believe there's a second prize and third prize involved. Now, this guy has long-range plans. He plans on developing the moon. So we'll see how Moon Express does. They've taken over a couple of launch complexes in Cape Canaveral. Launch complex 37. He's got to be able to use that land really to test his lunar creations that he plans on using. They're not going to use it as a launch facility to launch to the moon. He's going to make use of that land. That's called Moon Express. How to bring that up? That came out, I consider that breaking news for the net. That came out a couple of days ago. So, as far as other regular news, the next flight of Dragon to the International Space Station is called CRS number 10. Let me drop it. CRS number 9 is already docked with the space station. That successfully did that a couple of weeks ago. And that has on board the ITER, the International Docking Adapter, which in a week or two, I believe on the 19th, they're going to have a spacewalk to attach the cabling and everything to the docking ring. This future ITER is going to be used for docking crewed American spacecraft to the International Space Station, coming up at probably the beginning of or the end of 2017 or the beginning of 2018 by either Boeing or SpaceX, whichever one makes it first. But the next flight is coming up in about a month or two, and that's going to be carrying the SAGE. They call it the SAGE 3. So that's a spacecraft that's going to be attached to the International Space Station, observing basically the ozone level layer and other components of the atmosphere. There's been a SAGE 1 and a SAGE 2, but this is a SAGE 3, first time that they've decided to attach it to the space station. Take readings. Let me drop it. It's only a couple hundred pounds. It'll be attached to the trunk of the Dragon spacecraft, similar to the system that Ida has. The trunk is the back part of the Dragon. Dragon is docked to the Harmony module on the Earth-facing side. And the robotic arm reaches into the trunk and removes the spacecraft, whatever might be in there. They've done this before recently, also with Beam. Beam is the inflatable module that was attached to the space station successfully, and now it's inflated. So with the help of SpaceX, they're going to have another observing telescope system, except this time looking at Earth on a regular basis. Let me drop it. So, that's following up probably since the 1980s, early 1980s, with SAGE 1. That was the one that started it all. It first really got involved looking at the ozone, found the ozone hole over the Antarctic. Now they plan on continuing that process. Stage two didn't last that long with this one. What's good about this one, if they have problems with it, it'll reattach to the space station, and most likely they would be able to easily make a repair if they had to. So now they'll have a continuous reading on the ozone and see how we're doing, seeing how the cutting back of the fluorocarbons have changed things. One other spacecraft that's going to be launched probably, I believe, in 2017 is the Solar Probe Plus. And that's going to go actually to the sun. I know I've talked about that, I think, last week. So I just want to bring that up again. Because that will eventually get readings of the chromosphere of the sun. It's going to get within 3.5 million miles of the sun. Closest spacecraft we've ever attempted to do something like that. And with that, it's going to fly a course around half a dozen orbits around the sun. But each time it passes Venus, it's going to use Venus to slow itself down to get a lower perigee to the sun. And once it gets into that 3.5 million mile range, it'll be the fastest spacecraft that's ever been launched. The
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Closest this thing is going to get. So, that'll bring up Solar Probe 2. That will probably also be launched by SpaceX rocket, Falcon 9 rocket built by SpaceX. A couple other topics, but if you just want to explore that, we'll do that for now, Dick. And if you want to do anything different, we can. After that, K2RIW, WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. Back to you, Dick.
To backtrack a little bit, when I was talking about the special conditions required to get life on Earth of the kind that we care about, 4.5 billion years of stable orbit, helped a lot by the moon, 4.5 years of very little bombardment, helped by the collection of Jupiter, a molten core that rotates, that makes a magnetic field on Earth. That magnetic field, not only does it operate your compass, but it establishes a Van Allen belt. That magnetic field is a beautiful shield. I mean, when you watch Star Trek and they tell you, we got to put up the shields, well, that magnetic field shields us from 99% or so of the cosmic rays that come from outer space toward Earth, the million mile an hour and 2 million mile an hour particles called solar wind, which would be peeling away our atmosphere if it wasn't for that magnetic field that deflects it, and a nice thick atmosphere. So the protection of the atmosphere, the protection of the Van Allen belt, the protection from ultraviolet rays because of the ionosphere, the magnetic field that helps keep that all together, the extra stability caused by the great big moment of inertia created by the moon, stabilizing our axis of rotation, and Jupiter. All of those conditions appear to be required. We're starting to get a lot of special conditions. Yes, you've got a little bit more than 100 billion stars per galaxy. Let me drop. And you got 100 billion galaxies, 10 to the 22 stars out there. So even if only one in a million have got these beautiful conditions that we're now describing, that still means you've got billions of stars that have life. But how close is the nearest one that has all of those conditions? Are they within any reasonable communication range? Going there for a long time is out of the question. But communicating with them, yes, that's possible. So these searches going on by TESS and Kepler and James Webb Space Telescope and all these other spacecraft. One of the main goals these days of NASA is to not only look for life, but look for the raw conditions that can allow life to form. Let me drop. We'd sure like to find out that we're not alone. We know we're not alone. I mean, that mathematically, you can guarantee that. That's the good news. The bad news, though, is the nearest star and planetary system, nearest solar system to us, with life on it that we care about, probably is going to be a good long distance away. And when we finally do find that life, the next question is, do they have a million-year or a billion-year head start on us? In which case, they might not want to communicate with us. They would be pretty bored. I mean, there's that beautiful colony of ants in your backyard. You don't spend very much time trying to communicate with them. And a civilization that's got a billion years head start on us, they might not find it very interesting to talk to us. So communicating is not going to be easy. The planet now that's going to go to the sun, let's see now, Solar Probe Plus. Let me drop. When you take a ball on the end of a string and you swing it over your head, what you're really doing is you're moving your hand in a cyclic manner, which is adding energy, and you can speed up that ball. And if you study real hard what you're doing, your hand is moving in a circle, the ball is moving on the string in a circle, but your hand is 90 degrees ahead. And that's the method by which it adds energy to the ball in the end of the string. Your hand is out of phase, 90 degrees ahead. If you intentionally moved your hand 90 degrees behind, you would take energy out of that ball in the string. You would slow it down. By the same token, when you do a flyby on the outside of a planet and you whip by it, you pick up some of the kinetic energy of that planet, and the flyby allows you to add extra energy. And we've done that to get to many of the outer planets. Almost all of the spacecraft going to the outer planets have done one or more flybys to gain energy. Let me drop. So going out requires more energy to be added to your spacecraft. Going into the solar system to visit Jupiter, Mercury, or to go in orbit around the sun at a low orbit, to go inward, you must subtract energy. You've got a whole lot of potential energy because we start off 93 million miles away from the sun. If by some means you could launch something into space from the Earth, which is moving 19 miles per second in its orbit around the sun, but you subtract that 19 miles a second, you make the object stop in space 93 miles away, and now it will fall straight toward the sun. When it does that, it would hit the sun at an extremely high velocity. I don't know the number, but maybe it's 50 miles a second. It's going to hit the sun. What was that again? What was the escape velocity on the sun, Paul, go ahead.
I have the two numbers of the speed for the different spacecraft. Helios 2, which launched many, many years ago, and that came up to around 40 miles per second. This one's going to be about three times faster, around 120 miles per second. And before that, I just multiplied it and figured out how many miles, and it was some 400, I think around $450,000 miles per hour. So it would be like going to the moon and back in 1 hour. Back to you, Dick.
And that's being in orbit around the sun, at this orbit where you're able to see, measure the chromosphere. And I think you're saying you're going to be 3,500 miles above the surface of the sun.
3.5 million.
3.5 million miles. And my guess is there's some very fancy shields on that spacecraft to make sure it doesn't get overheated. Almost all the instrumentation is hidden behind that shield. Isn't that true, Paul?
Oh, yes. They have the shield is carbon-carbon, so everything will be hidden behind that. What's going to happen is it'll be traveling eventually to the sun. So as long as it's above 1/4 or 0.25 AU, it'll have a regular solar panel. supplying the energy. They only need, I think, 300 or 400 watts to make this thing work. So now the solar panel will become useless as it gets closer to the sun. So they go below the 20.25% of AU, and the panels will fold behind the carbon. You know, they could actually call it the umbra, you know, just like it was in shadow of the moon, that type of thing. They call it the umbra. So it'll go into shadow in the spacecraft, and then they'll be using a smaller solar panel. And let me drop it. Which is going to be cooled. They're going to use their cooling substance that they haven't described it yet. My guess would probably be an ammonia system of some sort, cooling that down. So just throughout the panels itself, you'll have coils, and that'll be the way they keep it cool. It'll be 550 times hotter at that location than it would be at Earth, you know, in orbit around Earth. Back to you, Dick.
Now, the field, is, you said, is going to be carbon-carbon, which is an absorptive material. It's a black material that's absorptive. When it comes to putting carbon-carbon on the leading edge of the space shuttle, so it can tolerate coming into the Earth's atmosphere at 16 times the speed of sound, and it gets a lot of leading-edge heating, and there you've got to tolerate that temperature. But in the case of solar energy, I'm amazed that they didn't make the shield out of something that's reflective. Make it like a mirror to reflect that energy back to the sun rather than absorb it. That seems a little strange, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
Hey, Tuesday.
They're worried about the carbon-carbon, the particles hitting the spacecraft, so you need a strong surface. I hear Eric, maybe he needs to do something.
You've got it, Eric.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody mentioned it. It's a little bit off the subject, but this week on the 11th and 12th, we've got a very good meteor shower. If you guys are going to do meteor scatter or just sit up and look at the sky, that's the time for it.
So it's the evening of the 11th and the morning of the 12th. Let's see now, 8th is Monday, 8, 9, 10, 11. I think that's coming Thursday. So Thursday night into Friday morning. Sounds like it's the peak of this particular Perseid meteor shower. And because of the way all of that debris from something Tuttle, I think is the name of the actual comet, we're possibly going to have a really significant Perseid meteor shower with maybe many meteors per, like the slim possibility of 200 meteors per hour. Are these roughly the numbers you've heard of, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW.
Yeah, they say it's double what we're normally used to seeing. And actually, a lot of the satellite operators are really worried because it wouldn't be the first time the Perseids has killed something.
Yeah, tell me about that. Was there a satellite that was impacted by a Perseids meteor? What satellite, when, how long ago? Over to you, Paul. I mean, Eric.
I think it was like 8 years ago or 10 years ago, I don't remember exactly. They're not exactly sure what it did. But don't forget, this is an almost microscopic-sized particle, but they're traveling at real high velocities. They very easily put a hole through not only the solar panels, but into the body of the spacecraft. So that's why they worry a little bit.
Is this one of these incidents, Paul, where at the peak of the meteor shower, the smart satellite operators might orient their satellite with the solar panels edge on to minimize the exposed area? Over to you, Eric.
That's the procedure that they follow, and it usually works from what I gather. But it wasn't an IntelSat, it was a domestic satellite that got wet.
Now, did the solar panel get hit, the body of the satellite get hit, the computer got hit, something vital got hit, and it knocked it out of operation. What was the failure, and how bad was that failure, Paul? I mean, Eric, KE2EJ, K2IW?
The failure was that it completely stopped talking. There was no command and control, and I don't remember exactly what happened to it, but it they couldn't control it, so it probably... Yeah, I can look it up. It probably hit the, either the power supply or some kind of control wiring or something of that nature. I don't think it was just a simple solar panel thing because they can usually recover from that.
It sounds like this was a geosynchronous satellite, 22,300 miles up. You have to do a certain amount of station keeping to keep it in the right spot. If you could no longer control it, it now drifts any way it wants to. And so... it's a little bit of a hazard for the other things in geostationary orbit. Is that true, Eric? K2IW?
Yeah, well, at that altitude, things tend to go out rather than come down, so... I don't know. Yeah, I look it up. I don't know exactly what the story was with it. I do know of a couple of satellites that ran out of gas, and they kept them going, even though it was, you know, wobbling all over the place.
Yeah, the way those orbits work, if you're in a higher orbit than geosynchronous, you slowly spiral outward. If you're in a lower orbit than geosynchronous, you slowly spiral inward. If you're right at geosynchronous, your average altitude stays there. You're going to wander to some other longitude, and you're going to start building up a whole lot of wobble in latitude. Right ascension and declination are going to start showing up as an error. But I still think you're going to stay at roughly the same average altitudes, Eric. K2EJ, K2IW.
Again, I don't know for sure which satellite it was and what happened to it, but I do know of the ones that ran out of gas. They did, before they ran out of gas, they did raise the altitude a little bit, and eventually it just spiraled out, which...
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The graveyard is up for a whole lot of reasons. Okay, so as I was starting to say, when you fly by the outer edge of a satellite that's a planet that's above you, you add energy to your trajectory, to your path. When you fly on the inner surface of a planet that's at a lower astronomical unit than us, you can subtract energy. So you don't want to use rocket fuel to do braking. Very expensive. If you can use Venus and Mercury to do braking, Earth, Venus, and Mercury, by flying by the right direction, you can allow them to subtract energy from your orbit, so you end up going around the sun, which is a much lower orbit than we're at. I think you said something like 0.3 astronomical units is where they're going to go, and they're going to be moving pretty fast when they're down there. So to subtract that energy is doing the opposite of the usual kind of flyby. The planets that we have, the spacecraft that we have sent to Mercury and Venus have had to do that. WS2N, K2IW, Greg Paul.
Yeah, we had Mariner for many years. That went around two times around the sun, but that had to use Venus to slow it down to do a couple of passes of Mercury, and then finally we had Messenger. Messenger was a spacecraft that actually went into orbit around Mercury, but to get there, it had two passes of Venus to slow it down. This one, to get to the sun, which is 3.5 million miles from the sun, at this ridiculously high speed of 120 miles per second, to slow it down to get it to do that, it's going to have to pass Venus six different times. Originally, they planned on actually sending it out to Jupiter and letting Jupiter, you know, slow it down. It wouldn't be the first time that they did a solar observation of the sun using Jupiter. we had a spacecraft called Ulysses that actually went into polar orbit around the sun. To do that, they went out to Jupiter and went to the south of Jupiter, to the South Pole, and used Jupiter to slingshot it around the sun. So that technique has kind of been used before, but they like this one better. Does it pass Venus half a dozen times to slow it down before it gets into position to head to the sun. That 3.5 million miles, that's close. That's a lot closer to Mercury. Mercury's, what, 80? I think it's 80 million miles.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
That distance. Things are going to get very hot very, very quick for that spacecraft. Back to you, Dick.
Now, once again, Paul, why is that shield not reflective? Why is that shield not a mirror? As opposed to a carbon-carbon material, which is black and is going to absorb the sunlight. That means it's going to get hot. And I'd like to not have a hot surface part of my spacecraft near my vital electronics. Over to you, Paul.
Well, they must figure that the carbon-carbon is going to be able to handle the heat. They need, whatever they use, they need to keep all the electronics in the shade. The idea of the carbon-carbon is really as a defense against the probably the electrons and protons coming off the sun. That's my guess. You know, carbon-carbon was the same material that was used at the leading edge of the wings of the space shuttle and the nose of the space shuttle. So that it wound up with the most heat. I think they were up to many thousands of degrees. So I guess if it was good enough for the shuttle, it should be good enough for the spacecraft. Back to you, Dick. KD2BAH.
KD2BAH, start up with your name and your information. Go right ahead.
Hello there, Dick. How are you? First name here is Kevin, Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Alpha Hotel. Just jumping in real fast to make a call to somebody to check their phone. KE2EJ, Mr. Eric, are you around, sir?
Eric was there earlier making adjustments. Let's see if Eric is there. KE2EJ, K2LAW. Kevin, if Eric comes back later, is there a message we should give him from you?
Yeah, if you hear him come back out here, just let him know that I sent him a text message to check his phone. That's all. Dick, thank you very much. Guys, go back on. Sorry for interrupting. KD2BAH, clear, but listen.
Is that Kilo Delta 2 Bravo Alpha Hotel?
QXO.
Okay, we'll tell him. Let's see, there were two repairs I did this week. I'm going to break off for a second and go back to space. Number one was the CR203 lithium battery for the memory, memory of the frequencies you encode into a rig. You know, the frequency memories, that has to be held up by, in the old days, a lithium battery. I had to replace one of those. But another discovery I made this week is that many of us try to be green. By that I mean, I think if you're following the rules for a newly installed basement, a newly installed bathroom, the flush tank is only allowed to have 1.5 or 1.8 gallons of water, whereas they used to have 5.5 gallons. I've got an older toilet, which has got the 5.5 gallons, but there's a catch. You can go to these tanks that have a much smaller amount of water. That's the good news. The bad news is they give you a much less enthusiastic flush, and you're going to have jammed pipes a hell of a lot more often. But even if you've got a 1.2 or 1.5 gallon tank flusher on your toilet of your bathroom, and I've got a 5, I think it's a 5 gallon. There's another nasty thing going on, and that is I discovered in my case, and I bet you I'm not unique, because every so often there's some particles in the water that's delivered to me. I can tell because I see those particles in the bottom of the tank. Those particles occasionally jam up in funny places in the toilet filling mechanism. Your toilet filling mechanism has got a float to it that when the water in the tank comes up to a certain level, it turns off the water supply. But until that happens, the water pouring into the tank, a certain percentage of it is supposed to go into the overflow tube, which means it ends up in the commode itself, which brings the water up to a certain level, and a certain percentage that then goes into the tank. Well, when the particle matter builds up in the wrong place, you can have the situation where your tank fills up with 5 gallons, but you may have shipped 15 gallons down the overflow tube, because the ratio of how much goes into the tank versus how much goes into the commode, into the overflow tube, gets drastically disturbed because particles build up in the wrong place and jam those channels. Let me drop. I discovered that mine was putting 5 times as much water down the overflow tube as it was putting into the tank. And I took that whole mechanism apart and poked wires in there and whatever to try to clean out whatever was jammed in those inner channels that stand disturbing that ratio. I wasn't successful. I just had to go out and buy a brand new toilet refilling mechanism. So I'll bet you a lot of people think they're very green because they've got a small number of gallons in the tank. And they don't even realize that if you time how long it takes for the tank to fill, you may discover that the water is running in there many more gallons than you're putting into the tank. So I bet you a lot of people don't know about that. I wonder if you've ever heard about this one. I'm going to ask John and Paul in that order. KC2WGB, have you ever heard about this problem, Paul? I mean, John, KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Oh, absolutely, Dick. A lot of issues with the ball cock, and if it's not adjusted right, you can be wasting a lot of water. And another thing about the new low-consumption toilets, most people are flushing them twice, which is something they didn't anticipate, because, like you said, you don't get enough of...
You said you don't get enough of, and then you dropped off.
Sorry about that. Just had a power outage. Amazing. Yeah, touching them twice has been a problem.
But I think a lot of people are not aware that the ratio of water going into the overflow tube, which means directly into the commode to bring the water back up to the right level, and the ratio of water going into the tank, that ratio can be easily disturbed by particles that get picked up into that system. And so if you're not actually looking at that, if you watch the thing fill, and you see the water slowly come up to the normal level in the commode, and then the water runs for a hell of a lot longer in order to finish filling the tank, you're wasting a lot of water. I'll bet you 20% of the population out there is wasting a tremendous amount of water they don't know about. And so I don't know if anybody has written an article on that one. Maybe you have heard of it, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Well, Dick, that's why the ball cock has an adjustment on it, which you watch it. When it goes to the overflow tube, which is required to finish the rinsing and to fill the bowl, and then once you see it hit that level, you don't allow it to run. You want to make sure it turns off. If it's not turning off at that time, even though it's adjusted properly, the ball cock is defective and you have to replace it. Yep.
Okay, you're describing an entirely different mode of failure. From the actual filling mechanism, some of the water pours directly downward from the filling mechanism and fills the tank. Some of the water goes through a black rubber tube, which pours a small amount of water into the overflow tubing, which goes into the commode. I'm talking about the ratio of water going through the black piece of tubing versus going straight into the tank. Even if your ball comes up to the right level and turns it off, your tank might not come up to that level until 5 more gallons have gone down the tube, down that black tube. That's what I'm talking about, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Well, Dick, once the ball comes up to the level, that tube should be shut off also. If it's not shutting off, there's, you know, an error in the ball cock assembly.
That's not what I'm saying. I know that when the ball cock turns off the water, it turns it off in both sources. While the tank is filling, while the ball cock is halfway up the side of the tank, the ratio of water going down the black tubing into the overflow versus the ratio of water going straight into the tank, if that ratio is wrong, you will overfill the commode 10 times before the water comes up to the right level to turn everything off. That's what I'm saying, John. KC2WGB, K2IW.
Okay, you've experienced something there I don't understand, because both of those are metered offices. You can't have them faster than normal. So I'm trying to think of how it could be the small, thin tube, usually an eighth of an inch diameter, can dump that much water without the ball cock rising, because the flow into the tank is far superior to the flow through that tube. Something doesn't sound right there.
The flow into the tank is far superior to the flow into the tube if the flow into the tank is not blocked by particles inside of that mechanism. And you try taking that mechanism apart and clean out those channels that go to the tank. They're very difficult to get to, and there's particles in there in my case. So in my case, the majority of the water pressure is going into the black piece of tubing that goes to the overflow. My commode fills 10 times over before the tank fills. The ratio is wrong because of blocked orifices of the water that's supposed to flow into the tank. In fact, in my case, those orifices are so blocked that if I try squeezing off the black piece of tubing to stop the water from flowing into the overflow tube, I cannot do it. Almost all the pressure is in my black tubing, and those orifices going down to fill the tank are so heavily blocked that my tank takes, I don't know the number of minutes, but if I timed it, I'll bet you it takes 5 minutes for my tank to fill. And so for 4.5 minutes, I'm dumping a hell of a lot of water into the commode and down into the sewer, and it doesn't have to be that way. That's why I went and bought a whole new mechanism. I tried cleaning out those orifices, and I wasn't able to get to them. They're hidden inside, very hard to get to in some designs of that mechanism. KC2WGB, K2IW.
NW. Now I know exactly what you're talking about, Dick. Yeah, and that's usually due to calcium deposits in that structure. That's usually what's blocking that. But, you know, some CLR run through there would probably break it up, but it's easier to change the ball cock.
Let's see what the ball's got to say about all the balls. Wait for the beeps, and you got a ball.
5 minutes is a long time. Mine takes 55 seconds, so. I wonder if you still have the float that goes up and down, that big ball that floats up and down, where you have the inverted bucket. You know, I changed over to the inverted bucket system decades ago. Back to you, Dick.
I have the inverted bucket, and that works very well when the level of the tank finally gets up there. But I don't know the exact number, but I think my tank takes 5 minutes to fill. And for 4.5 minutes, I'm pouring a hell of a lot of water down the drain, because it's a way over ratio of water going down that black piece of tubing. That's why I've replaced that whole mechanism. And maybe it could be cleaned out. So you think it's calcium deposits. I think it's particles. My water occasionally has particles. When they repair a broken water line, some dirt gets into it. And I know that dirt is getting into my water system, obvious by the fact that I can see those dirt particles in the bottom of the tank. When you look in your tank, is everything in there, is the bottom of your tank absolutely clean, or is there a whole lot of stuff in there that you think shouldn't be there? Over to you, John, first, and then Paul in that order. KC2WGB, K2IW.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, if you look in your tank, you will notice where the water level stops. Above that, you'll have the white porcelain. Below that, you have a brownish sludge, and that's all part of the mud and all of the sediment that comes in. And it could be that, but it's usually lime deposits. But what's happening now is, now the thing that Paul has, the inverted bucket, that is all a plastic assembly. That usually doesn't collect lime. So if it's a plastic assembly, it's probably particles of mud and stuff that came in on the main line.
The stuff in the bottom of my tank is not only a brown sludge on the side of the tank. There's actual pebbles, very small pebbles, in the bottom of my tank. And I guarantee some of them jammed into my mechanism. My mechanism is made out of plastic. It's an inverted bucket. But the very bottom of that mechanism is metallic in my case. And it's got some plastic parts inside. And if you try taking out the little rubber washer, which is a real starter and stopper with a little pin in the center of it, and then you look inside there, the actual vents that go down to pour water into the tank, in my case, I can only find one little vent that's open, and all the others seem to be jammed, and I couldn't even unjam them by pushing pieces of wire in there. That's why I replaced the whole mechanism. So your tank fills up in 55 seconds. Each of us, what we should do is take the cover off the tank when the tank, when the thing has been flushed. Watch the level of the water filling up in the commode itself to the right level, and then how far down from the top is the water in the tank? Because if the water in the tank, in my case, is 20% of the right altitude, when enough water has poured through the black piece of tubing to bring the water in the commode up to the right level, my tank water is only 20%. When for it to go from 20% to 80%, for all of that next water coming into the system, 80% of that water, so to speak, is pouring into the commode, 20% of it is going into the tank. And so I think I've got a 5-gallon tank. I'll bet you I'm pouring 20 gallons into the system every time I flush. So I wonder what particle matter you've seen. I wonder if you've ever done that careful timing that I just talked about, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW. In other words,
repeater, timeout.
Your tank fills in 55 seconds. Maybe it only took 30 seconds to fill your commode, Paul. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, everything stops running at 55 seconds. That's how I know everything is good. You got to understand the purpose of the black plastic tube coming off the, usually made by Mast, is the I believe that's the name of the company. It's a common one. You get them in eighth. It's usually about $8 to $10. The good thing now is they used to be guaranteed for 3 years, and now I think they've stepped it up to 5. So that's good. That means they're improving on these things.
Dick, K2UBS has a comment when you get a chance.
Bill, Roger. On the inside of the tube, bring up that water level on the inside of the bowl. The water is for the tank is really being filled by the other opening right near the inverted bucket. So that's the two processes that are going on. But to have a 5-minute fill like that, it's probably most cases it's the plunger that's holding back the water. That's usually leaking, deteriorated, gravel in your case being caught underneath. It's taking a long time for it to completely seal. So that's running and running and running. That's usually the most common problem for a long fill. And sometimes it gets so bad that, you know, if you don't jiggle around the handle, that thing will never stop or run forever. Back to you there.
You might be talking about a leaking stopper, flapper. That's not my problem. My problem, the ratio of water flowing into the commode and ratio of water flowing into the tank is 5-to-1, the wrong ratio. In my case, very wasteful. And maybe Rich has already investigated this problem. K2UPS. How flush are you, K2RIW? Go ahead there, Rich.
And did you change the water level? You could change the water level on those on those inverted bucket systems when you buy them.
I know I can change the water level. That is not the problem. Over to you, Rich.